And now I'm very, very pleased to announce a person that I met because of my belonging to the group I mentioned before, a person whom I admire, and a person, well, I Manny mentioned in introducing me that I took a master's degree at London School of Economics, which was a marvelous thing, and it was an eye-opening experience. And the major thing that I learned at LSE, and Manny mentioned this also, is if you read enough, you will find out what's going on. At that time, the library at LSE only had one of every title of book. Now they've improved it tremendously. That was almost 20 years ago. But if you read enough, even of the bad books, you get the gist. I started reading, and I read for the last 10 years, but I haven't read a quarter of what Bob McIlvaine has read. Every time I have a question about something, I try to get in touch with Bob and ask him, what should I look at here? Because Bob has read not only about 9/11, not only about government, not only about the CIA, the FBI, all of the secret intelligence agencies, plus on and on, but the basics of government. He has a few PhDs in what he's read, and I'd like to get off here and bring him up so he can tell you some of his wisdom.
This computer, is this your computer, John?
No.
No. Can I just put the thing down? I really am, you know, I should be used to doing this because I've been doing it for, you know, since 2002 when I finally decided to get involved in things. I'm really scrambled. I'm emotional. Usually it takes me a while to get into a speech before I get emotional, but it's difficult. This is why 9/11 families don't get involved, because it's just so sore. It's like I'm back that day, you know, when we got a call about the, or when I saw the towers come down. And I don't want to go into that whole story. I don't want to go. I'm going to talk about Bobby, and I want to go into Tower One. Bobby died. Oh, we had a difficult time finding what happened to Bobby. Bobby worked at Merrill Lynch. Bobby's a Princeton graduate. He was an English major with a minor in African-American literature. Profoundly intelligent person. 26 years old. And if you talk to anybody about Bobby, the first thing people would say, If Bobby was here and you're sitting down with him, you would never know that he was, you know, a Princeton grad, honors in high school, captain of his basketball team, because if you sat with him for an hour, you'd be the only one ever speaking, and you'd walk away, and I said, I don't know anything about that kid. That's how good he was with people. Never, ever would ever talk about himself. He started, left Princeton, went to New York. He wanted to be a writer. Great, great writer, prolific reader, constantly reading. And this is where I get my energy and my strength, because he believed knowledge is power. And that's the truth. Because if you don't, then it gives me power. And when he went to New York, he was in publishing, because he figured, well, this is going to be my thing. I want to be a writer. And then he then got into the PR business, and his only job was to work with Merrill Lynch. Well, right before, I guess it was July 2001, Merrill Lynch offered him a job as vice president of media relations, because he was just such a great writer. He would do writing for people in Merrill Lynch, because not many people have great writing skills. And he made a deal with Merrill Lynch that he was going to get his MBA, either at Penn or Harvard. He was going to enroll at either place. And Merrill Lynch would help him with it because we couldn't afford it anymore after 4 years of Princeton. And then they said, as long as you work with us for 2 years, then you can do anything you want. And he loved his job. So he lived across the he worked across the street at Merrill Lynch, North Tower, and across the street, West Street, was Merrill Lynch. So that day, and again, I don't want to get into the whole day itself. I really want to talk about the North Tower. But I was working, I worked at a psychiatric hospital as a counselor and a teacher. And someone called me in, and we watched the towers going down. And I really wasn't that worried because he worked at Merrill Lynch. Well, anyway, we never got a phone call from him. And, of course, that's when we started getting worried. We went up Tuesday, and that week, and believe it or not, that you know, we're one of the lucky ones. We took him home. Because, you know, I have a Philadelphia support group, and they haven't found a peace of their children. And most of them have lost children. So I want to take you into that morning. I want to go into the North Tower. I spent a lot of time this week reading the NIST reports. And, of course, you know, this report. Now, I've read it. I spent, after 9/11, I got involved with Peaceful Tomorrows, and it was the greatest thing that ever happened in my life. I got to go to Japan. I spoke in Bogota. I really had an opportunity to speak what I felt. And I thought that the Afghan War and the Iraq War were just ridiculous, regardless of who did it. The story being 19 Arabs killed my son. And I said, what are we going to war for? Let's bring them to justice. So I had the opportunity to join Peaceful Tomorrows. And we did astounding things. And I was able to speak to the world. For years, I went to high schools. Everybody wanted me to speak because I wasn't seeking revenge. And they loved that message. But then after going to these 9/11 committees, I made 90% of these commission hearings. And it was a joke. And again, it was after Condoleezza Rice spoke in the hearings. And it was a filibuster. She could care less about what happened. She just kept saying, well, we have to keep things in historical perspective. Well, I've never been so pissed off in all my life. And that's when I made the decision. I had an interview with CBC afterwards. And I just, you know, people all around, I said, this is effing ridiculous. I was so pissed off. Now, I've carried that anger. That's why I get so emotional, because I have that anger, tremendous anger. And I have to really watch myself. I have to work hard to keep my sanity, because that's all I do. And I know the truth hasn't been told. You know, you look at this book, and Manny mentioned Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. 441 footnotes in this book. 441 footnotes talking about the story, the masterminds of 9/11. Yet this man was tortured 183 times. That's what they based the whole book on. And it's based on torture. Yet American citizens accept this, that we will actually torture people to get a confession. And I doubt very much the man is alive. But that's here and there. So what I want to talk about is that morning, but keep it in the context. I'm not going to talk about Building 7, but move right into Building 7. 8:46, I think the seconds were, 8:46:40. Bobby came down. He lived at 66 between first and second. And it's taken me, you know, and I finally talked to the doctor who examined him that morning. He was taken right from the morgue. He was one of the first 10 bodies found. At first, we were upset that we thought that Merrill Lynch was running a seminar on the 106th floor. And we thought that, geez, maybe it was up there. But the fact that we found the body, we figured, how could that have possibly? And then, you know, my wife even said, do you think he jumped? Well, the thought of that was just, although I really admired the people that did it because they made the decision how they're going to die. I mean, that's probably the most courageous act I've ever could think of. But through my investigation, when I do the 9/11 investigations, I'm also trying to find out exactly how my son died. And I want you all to put yourself in my shoes. You know, it's hard enough losing a child. But then when your child's murdered, and, you know, people say, well, if you had found any closure, you'll never find closure. I think the best way to look at it is that your suffering isn't as bad as it used to be. You know, a psychiatrist told me, you know, we did a lot of therapy. You know, it's tough on families. And we were, you know, we had to work these through. My wife doesn't want to talk about 9/11, which I don't blame her. But he said, it's like you have a half-dollar bill right afterwards, and you just can't see anything. Plus, years go by that goes out here, so you see peripherally. You know, I can laugh. At first, your suffering just is overwhelming. You grieve. But the pain is still there, and I make the decision to keep the pain. It's important. But this is why 9/11 families don't get involved. Who wants to go through this shit? Really, it's tough. So that morning is very important to me, how he died. Did he suffer? And again, put yourself in my shoes. Now, put yourself in my shoes and think of this. Your loved one, your child, daughter, or son were murdered. This is a murder, regardless of who did it. Now, I go to all these investigations, or, you know, all the commission hearings. Now, let me just read. Now, Bobby died, I'm 100% sure, he died as the plane hit or even before the plane hit, and that's what I want to talk about, okay? Because I sat down, I didn't look at his pictures, they had pictures of him, but at the morgue in New York City said, look, I strongly recommend that you don't look at him. I feel bad that I didn't, I can still look at him if I want, but his wounds or his death, I think it was immediately spontaneous. I don't think he ever knew what hit him because all his injuries were in the chest, lacerations of the chest. His whole face was blown apart. Over the years, we've actually gotten piece of his brains, his little pieces of skull. That's brutal, but I feel good getting them. That we take them home because it's at that dingy little morgue. They have all the stuff in the trailers, and people are really having a difficult time taking these pieces of their body. But I have people in the support group, my support group, that they have nothing. You're talking about a body that's blown to, it's atomized. That's hard to believe, that they have nothing. I have a grave. It's unbelievable. I can go to the grave every week. They have nothing, absolutely nothing, and that's painful. So that morning, the plane hits the North Tower. As the plane goes in, you have the wings, and the wings were immediately sheared off. That's where all the fire is, or all the gasoline or kerosene. It's at a 10% angle, goes from 93rd to the 98th floor. Most of your damage was between 93 or 94, 96. Okay? Now, to show you what a great investigation, I mean, I really, really have such contempt for these people in the 9/11 Commission. This is their entire investigation of what happened up there at the towers. It's on page 285, civilians, fire safety personnel, 9/11 calls. North Tower. A jet fuel fireball erupted upon impact. There was a big explosion. Now, they said NIST said that there was 10,000 gallons of fuel on that plane. And basically, to round things off, they said 33% blew up immediately, 33% filtered itself throughout the floor, and 33% went down elevator banks, and caused all this damage, and that's basically what I want to talk about real fast. A jet fuel fireball erupted upon impact and shot down at least one bank of elevators. The fireball exploded onto numerous lower levels, including the 77th and 22nd, the West Side Lobby level, and the B4 level, four stories below the ground. That's it. So that's, you know, they're explaining how everyone died by just generally saying a fireball. Now, I just want to read these. Tony sent me these. And these are from testimonies, eyewitness testimonies of firemen, EMT workers that went into the building. Can't find it. How about that? Well, Doesn't matter. People that went in, now this is a minute after the plane hit. And again, these are testimonies. Now, I've talked to, I don't know how many firemen. We talked about Schroeder. But it seems like the fact that I talked to these people, they told me this. Again, people give you this glazed look. But these are testimonials that people had. They walked in. And the big thing that people don't understand, the condition of the lobby. The devastation of people in the lobby. And I don't want, you know, I don't know, maybe a family member was here and had someone in the lobby. I don't want to describe their injuries, but a lot of charred people. The lobby of the North Tower, 208-foot square. That's a big lobby. 99 elevators. I remember I was up with Bobby and Jeff one time, and we decided that we were going to go to the top. Well, I gave up. It was too complicated to get on those elevators. You have a three-tier system of elevators in the North Tower. You have 24. You only had three elevators that went to the top. What you would do, you would go, if you took those tiers, then you would get up to the 78th sky lobby. And then from the 78th sky lobby, you would take up to the higher levels. Now, two of the express elevators, they said went down six and seven. Now, there's one testimony of a fireman and a cop went into, he came into the west side. That's the entrance to the North Tower. So the West Street, Merrill Lynch is right behind, or right across the street. He walked in, and his description of some bodies he had seen, but there was an explosion that happened. Now, he got there a minute, 2 minutes after the plane hit. The west side, he talks about the lights are out. Talked about a couple of the bodies he had seen, that they couldn't help these people, yet they were still alive. They were charred. And he mentions that he looks to the side. The express elevator 6A and 6 and 7, they're on the south side and north side. So you're walking in the west side. You have these towers or the elevators to right and left. Now, he said, I couldn't say for sure, but they looked like they were clear. Everything was fine over there. But the thing that he noticed, that the freight elevators, which are in the middle, the doors were totally blown out. And this is very revealing, because hopefully I'll be able to explain that. And all the windows of the lobby were blown out. Now, this is 208 square. And the commission says a fireball went down one of the banks, obviously then came into the lobby and blew out all those windows. Well, the destruction of those elevator doors was monumental. They were blown out. And they talked about floor 22, how they came up with floor 22, but this is to show you, they just nitpick. They'll blame 9/11 people for cherry picking. You know, I don't know how many times, and I wish some people, they would say it to my face so I could smack them in the mouth. You know, I'm cherry picking. Well, I'm not cherry picking. Floor 22, which is the security center. Now, had no access to any of the elevators going up, the express elevators. None. So, 9/11 Commission report saying that the fireball destroyed 22. And this is the security center. Not that it's a big deal, but, you know, they have access to all the doors. The doors open and close because of them. Closed circuit TV. It did hinder the rescue efforts because of some doors were unlocked. They couldn't get into it. And then NIST said, I mean, this is phenomenal. NIST said, well, no, it wasn't from a fireball. It was from debris, falling debris. So that means the tower, the plane hit, and all that debris came around the side and decided to break into the 22nd floor and destroy that floor. Well, the whole floor was destroyed. The elevator was blown out. Yet again, 23 and 21 were in pristine condition. Well, that's mind-boggling to me. And now we get to the sub-basement. Again, what do they say? Well, the fireball went down in the sub-basement. Well, I've talked to somebody, Willie Rodriguez. God knows how many conversations I've had with him, and he's really helped me with this because he was in the lobby immediately afterwards. I still haven't found the person that found my son, and they didn't take grids at that time, so I don't have the exact location. But the damage to the lobby is just to the sub-basement is mind-boggling. $10,000 machinery just blown up to the machine shop on the third level, absolutely blown up. Yet what did they talk about explosives? Nothing, absolutely nothing. One fireball comes down. Then you have freight elevator 50. Again, the 9/11 Commission report says, well, and even this, probably 50A they call it, is what caused the problem down at the bottom because it fell down to the bottom and then exploded. Well, on CNN, guy reports that he was running the 50A, and he had gotten up to approximately the 15th floor, and the plane hits. Well, his cables break. Well, he assumed he was a dead man because it'll go all the way down to the B6 level. Well, just as it got underground, the emergency brakes. All those elevators have emergency brakes. And it stopped. And then as soon as it stopped, the door blew in. Well, we got another fireball. It came down and decided to blow the 50 freight elevator in. The door blows into the cabin. He breaks his leg. Then another explosion, and that's when he loses unconsciousness. He survived. So 50A, in other words, the thought of fire or fuel coming down, any of the things is almost impossible. All the shafts, top to bottom until it got to the bottom, are made of drywall. Well, those gasoline particles, they would be grabbing on. I mean, that's 90-some floors that came down. And they're saying the fireball destroyed the tower. Mr. Schroeder, that Manny talked about, I talked to him, I remember many times, he said, it looked like a plane hit the lobby. That's how bad that lobby was. And we're saying a fireball. It's impossible for a fireball to come out, even if it was coming from the top, to come out and then blow up all those windows in the North Tower. It is impossible. Absolutely impossible. Yet, I don't know how many people here have read this. I guarantee you 99% of the people in the United States haven't read this. And I get one goddamn little paragraph to describe how my son was murdered. That's it. Right there. That little stupid thing. They're saying, well, 2270 lobby and basement were all destroyed because of our stupid-ass firewall they keep talking about. Well, that makes you angry. So with that, talking to the doctor, my son's doctor, or not his doctor, the one that examined him, we sat down for an hour, and he had drawn his body figure and explaining all his injuries. And again, he took everything to the chest and the head. And I got his wallet, and it had that white soot. And there's another thing, the white soot that was in the lobby. It's not from fire. It's from explosions. Fire leads of different type of soot. So there's no ifs, ands, and buts that there was huge explosions below and came up into the lobby. You cannot question that. So my thing is, he came over from Fulton Street. He made the decision that he was going to go to the top. Now, we got no phone calls from him. And I would think if the plane had hit, he would have started running. So certainly there was no injuries to his back. Back of his skull was intact. And he had postmortem burns. That means I think he was walking in. And the huge explosion took place, and I think the glass and the force of the explosion did the damage to him. And then someone finally picked him up and took him to the morgue right away, and again, it was one of the first 10 bodies. So I'm getting to the point, I could care less who did this. I know what the truth is. But again, people will look at me, what do you know? I'm not at college. I'm not working at Princeton. You know, I wish the Princeton people would come out. I know Falk, he has come out, and he feels very strongly about what happened on 9/11. But the thing is, people look at me, and, you know, Lee Hamilton, again, if I'd seen Lee Hamilton when he said this, I was on a TV show with him from Canada, and he says, well, I think Bob's really speaking from emotion, and he really doesn't have his facts right. You know, son of a bitch, if I would have been there, I would have strangled him. And there's a man, Lee Hamilton, and I don't want to get too far, but Lee Hamilton, I sat in his office with the Jersey girls. This is after the first report came out, the Blue Book, and you had the, I think, 28 redacted pages in it, and we were talking to him, and we wanted to know, why did they redact 28 pages about the Saudis? You know, here are the Saudi Arabians, you know, they had left the country. All the hijackers supposedly came from Saudi Arabia. Well, we wanted to know, what the hell's going on here? And Lee Hamilton is exactly what he said. He says, you know, I really understand what you're saying, but he said it was up to me because of national security. I couldn't release that information. Now let's go back to the 80s, October Surprise. If you don't know what it is, Google it. He helped squash that investigation. And then when I'm looking through the Iran-Contra trials, quote from Lee Hamilton, because of national security, we can't give any more information about this. Well, talk about a gatekeeper. And this man's running the 9/11 commission hearing. And then he tells me, I'm emotional about this. Well, this is what we're dealing with in the United States. It's my job as a parent to find the truth. I've found the truth. I don't care what anyone says. You know, as much as I want an investigation, I've done my investigation. But what, I'm not Henry Kissinger? I'm not a politician? Why would anybody trust any of these people? Who are we going to have that's going to give us an investigation? We're going to have to search wide and far to find good people to do that. I wouldn't trust anybody in the United States, especially if they're involved with government. So, I truly, truly support everything that's happening with Building 7, but I'm on my journey. And I know when it's my transformation. And I just want to end on this as far as I don't care if someone goes to jail. I don't care if someone hangs. There's so many people that were involved in 9/11. But the fact that the 9/11 Commission report and NIST covered up these explosions, it's either Osama bin Laden was working with the United States government or someone else murdered my son through use of explosions. But I think personally, I think with this, I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'm just talking to my son. Please remember, I'm not speaking for anyone else in the 9/11 movement. I'm not speaking for the families. I speak for myself. That I believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the Muslim world had nothing to do with the murder of my son. Thank you. And that's important to me. Because I've had the opportunity, I said, I spoke at a conference in Bogota. It's that empathy that much of America doesn't have. To see what the, you know, my son's death. But then to talk to the people, I went to it's a conference in Bogota, 2005 I think it was, on violence around the world. People from Bali were there, Chechnya. And then talking to the people in South America and Central America. I still try to work on the SOA, School of Americas down in Fort Benning. I've spoken down there. That, as Valerie was talking about, the innocent victims of the world, because not just the United States, this is the way governments work. It's pure Machiavellian, all governments, not just the United States. Again, I don't care if they convict anybody for 9/11. But this is what has to stop. This is what people have to look at. That's why you have to study history. How many people have died since World War II, and innocent civilians dying. As Valerie said, wars used to be fought between soldiers. Now nothing but innocent civilians. And we're talking of millions. And to talk to a mother in Ecuador because her two daughters had, quote, left-leaning thoughts, labor unions, and they just disappeared off the face of the earth. A black woman living in Colombia. We had dinner, and I was eating dinner with a lot of people from, South and Central America. Third-degree burns, well, she's healed, but burns all over her body. Lost her kids and her husband. Of course, it's terror, but it wasn't the FARC. It was the paramilitaries from Colombia. And the stories go on and on and on. This is what we have to look at. It's all innocent civilians. And governments, not just the United States government, all governments, they don't care. They live by that Machiavellian philosophy. And this is where I would rather go. I want accountability, but people really have to look at history. And it's not astounding that a government would kill 3,000 people. Not, of course, they wouldn't know how many people were going to die. This is the way governments work. I was speaking to Oliver North in the 80s. He didn't care if every human being in the South Central, every inner city in the United States were taking drugs. That's good industry. Build a prison. Because he felt, in the Iran country, he felt that he's doing his duty for the country. He could care less how many people were ODing on crack. Well, this is what government people do. It's the government, it's the nation that counts. So it's not beyond my realm of thinking that why wouldn't the United States look at the world the way it is? Why wouldn't they do 9/11? And that's why I'd rather people see that, no, the Muslims had nothing to do with it. And I don't know where to go from it. And I'll bring you right into my introduction. This is what Richard Gage has done. It's because of people like Richard Gage, I have an opportunity. People come to family members. As difficult as it is, but we have the French film crew here. And they were down in Pennsylvania in January because of the Building 7. Then I have an opportunity to speak to the world. I've had the opportunity to do other DVDs. So it gives me that. And I will tell the truth. And I don't care what other people say. No one's done the legwork that I've done. And they call me a conspiracy theorist. Well, I'll tell them to stick it up their ass. I don't really care. I said, again, put yourself in my shoes, and your child's murdered, and the guy lives up the street that murdered your child because the judge in the county doesn't want an investigation because he's a good friend of his. Well, that's basically what it is. These pieces of shit, what did they do? It's all junk, absolute junk. And they act sanctimonious when they're speaking to people because they gave us all the recommendations, how to make this better, stop terrorism. Well, that's my goal in life. That's my journey in life. And Richard Gage, he has done so much to keep this in the public eye. He's an architect of 23 years. I stay away from, this is the first time I've done this. This is very painful. I'm a wreck. Doing this all week because all I'm doing is looking at my son's death. Usually I get very global. We can talk about the put options. We can talk about, of course, NORAD. I could go for hours on that. But here's the nitty gritty. Tower 7, of course, they never mention in the book. And then they give me a little line here about some stupid-ass fireball going down and exploding everything underneath, which is an impossibility. So Richard, an architect of 23 years, and the 1,400 architects and engineers that he started, he goes around the world. He keeps the issue alive. And me, as a family member, that means so much because as much as it brings you down, it's so necessary because I owe it to my son. And the thanks I have to give to Richard and the fact that he keeps that out there is mind-boggling to me. because it keeps my son's name alive. I get the opportunity to speak because he's working 80 hours a week. I feel guilty. I put a lot of time in, but I'm not working 80 hours a week. He's putting 80 hours a week in because he didn't believe the story. And it's so concrete. No matter what you say, people look at me and they get starry-eyed. I'm ostracized in my neighborhood. They're just scared to death that I might bring up 9/11. My wife's scared to death. We don't go out socially anymore because she's scared to death that 9/11 might come up. And I go on one of my tirades like this. And then if the asshole, one of my friends, questions me, well, then we really have a problem. And that's what my wife's afraid of. Because I can't, I really have a difficult time. I remember talking to a psychiatrist, and he says, you know, we're talking about depression. Depression's a big part of so many people in 9/11. And it's very difficult to, you know, just keep looking at this and not getting depressed. But the other side of the coin of depression is anger. And it's so important to me, and I know it sounds not funny, but sort of tragic, that it's so important for me to keep the anger. And I have to work, I really have to work hard to get around that. I want to be angry every day, but the thing is, I have to work out. I really have to try to keep myself in good shape. You have to find diversions. So I've learned, I stay angry all morning. I do all my reading, and you know, I go to Barnes & Noble, have a latte, and do my reading. That's good for me. And then there's a certain point in the day that I cut it off. Work around the house, and of course, working out's a big thing. Like this week, I spent the whole week. I do this at night. I'm wide awake all night long. Can't do it. Last night, I couldn't sleep. I'm so worked up. It's, you know, and I told someone yesterday, it's like taking drugs. This gives me a high because you have people that are searching for these answers. But then, when you take drugs, what happens? You fall. And this, you know, I ride home. Then, you know, then suddenly you're back to your neighborhood where no one could give a shit about 9/11. They don't want to hear it. They want to go on their lives. That's depressing. Really, really depressing.